Folk session number 13249, reel 1.
Charles Anscombe, reel 1. Whereabouts were you born, please?
Can I not quite?
Can you tell me where it is again, please?
Near the Thousand Isles. That's on the lakes, on the Great Lakes.
In Canada?
In Canada.
Which year were you born?
1908.
And what did your father do for a living?
He was a builder.
Self-employed?
He was then, yes.
Did you go to school in Canada?
No. We moved to Buffalo in New York. A short time. I don't think it was for very long. And I remember going to school in Buffalo. And one of the things that sticks in my mind is that there's quite a few black children in the class. Well, America is the land of the free and the home of the brave, isn't it? They had all kinds and all conditions.
But eventually you went to Britain.
To Britain, home here, yes. Came home I don't know why we came. Came on the Virginian, an Allen liner, which no longer exists.
How old were you when you came back to Britain?
6. Well, it was 1908, and this was 1914.
Which part of Britain did you settle down in?
Where you are now, working with relatives. If you're looking, you're probably in your telephone directory, you'll find plenty of Anscombes around there. Though, perhaps not, because I think they're all on the female side. They probably have their husband's name.
So you went to school in Woking?
Yes, I went to the Goldsworth Road School. I don't know if you know Goldsworth Road.
Yes.
But I don't know for how long. Maybe 6 months.
How old were you when you left school?
Well, when I went in the Navy.
You tell me that was 15 years old.
Well, not really, because I went through a training ship, Warspite, first, when I was 14 and 3 weeks in 1922. I went to Warspite on the 20th of February, 1922. And from Warspite, I was on her about 15 months, and then May the following year, I joined the Navy.
Was this HMS Warspite?
No, training ship Warspite, Marine Society.
What was the training like on Warspite?
It was like an ordinary school, really. The education was quite comprehensive. We not only dealt with sort of matters concerning the sea, but also general schooling.
So this is in 22-23?
Yeah.
Where was Warspite anchored?
Well, they had the Tilbury Hotel at Tilbury itself. For the first 9 months I was on her. And then they had a ship, an ex-third-class cruiser, HMS Hermione, which was berthed at Greenhithe in Kent. And we went from Tilbury to... Don't ask me the date, so I couldn't tell you. All I know was in 1922.
You went from Warspite to Hermione?
Yeah, well, Hermione, but she was renamed Warspite, so still carried on the ship's name.
What was the training like?
Oh, well, it was very similar to the Navy. We had, as I say, the normal type of schooling. I was fortunate, I suppose. I was put in what they called the advanced class. I should imagine it's similar to a scholarship, I don't know. And our schooling was separate to the general run on the Warspite. who were known as what I call advanced class boys.
How were you treated?
Well, the food was plenty of it, but not very appetizing, I'm afraid. It was just very ordinary food.
Was there any ill treatment?
Oh, no, not ill treatment, what you would call ill treatment. A cuff round the ear if you didn't behave yourself, but from an instructor. But apart from that, the only thing is they used to, for smoking, for instance, you used to get perhaps 6 cuts of a cane over a box horse because you weren't allowed to smoke. But generally speaking, I haven't got any complaints. I'd never left home before, and it was a bit tough to start. But eventually I settled down and decided to make the most of it.
And you were trained in HMS Ganges?
I went to Ganges after that. But when I first joined, my father was dead against it. And he had me down to go to the School of Building in London. I don't know if you're following the same line of business as he was himself. And I told him I didn't want to. So he gave me half a crown the night I left, and he said, "You've made your bed, you've lie on it, and this is all you'll ever get out of me."
Did he keep his promise?
Eh?
Did he keep his promise?
Well, he did. And he didn't. I couldn't discuss anything with it to do with what I was doing. He just didn't want to know. But he did. He read in the Telegraph that I'd been awarded the DSM in 1940, and he did write to me to congratulate me. But he never really kept it up. But he just what I was doing was of no interest to him. But I saw him and. He was all right, I suppose, but he was like all Victorian fathers, I think. If you crossed them, that was it.
And what about HMS Ganges? How did the training compare?
They were as strict. I had no fault to find with it. We were well fed on Ganges. Well fed, very well fed. And we had a chance of partaking in all forms of sport. I don't know if this is of any interest, but while I was there, I was a reasonably good swimmer. And through the Ganges, I managed to get the Royal Life Saving Society Awards up to the Award of Merit, which I probably would never have done if I hadn't been on Ganges.
Were you ever punished whilst you were in Ganges?
No, I managed to keep out of the way.
What branch of the Navy did you go into when you finished in Ganges?
Seaman.
In what kind of ships?
My first ship was the Iron Duke. I was on her for a short while. And I was transferred to her, from her to the Marlborough, which was another ship, battleship of the same class, both coal burning. And then I went home and I was sent to the Daney, light cruiser. And I was on her from, I've got to stop and think. It's all in my record, actually.
Yes, it's all in the record, don't worry.
And anyway, I went to the Daney and I was on her for about 3 years. As a point of interest, we did some very, very fine cruises on her. On one occasion, we went to a cruise in the Black Sea and went 81 miles up the Danube to a place called Galatz, which I don't think I would have ever done if I hadn't been in the Navy. And that was my object in joining the Navy, because in my position I couldn't afford to go around the world, but in the Navy, that afforded me that opportunity. And then in 1927, the Danny was sent, which was, I forget which squadron it was, four or five cruisers in it, Dauntless, Delhi, Danny, and the Frobisher, which was a flagship with the Earl of Cork and Orrery. Paddy Boyle, I expect you've heard of him, have you?
Yes.
And we were sent to China for the first communist rising in 1927. And we travelled around China quite a bit.
What did you... Did you go to Shanghai?
Yes, we went to Shanghai.
Did you see anything of the disturbances?
Well, we were kept out of it, but we were there in case for evacuation of British people, things like that. And that quietened down, and we came back to the Mediterranean.
You were telling me that during the Invergordon Mutiny, you were out in the Far East.
Ah, this was later on. I'm talking about 1927 now. The Invergordon Mutiny was 31. My next ship was a Magnolia, which was a coal-burning sloop. And we used to do wireless guard when the fleet wasn't at Wai. You've heard of that, no doubt. We maintained wireless guard. We were there over the winter and things like that. And after we came back from Wai Hai, the fleet used to go up to Wai Hai for the summer, and we would be where the fleet wasn't. In other words, we'd be down in Hong Kong. I went on one very interesting cruise in 1931 when the Invergordon Mutiny was on. We went right round Indonesia, Java and Sumatra, all the places like Bengkulu, Palembang, Batavia, which as you know is Jakarta now, and we did a 4 month cruise. So that satisfied my idea of going into the Navy to see the world.
Why do you think there was no trouble in the Far East in 31 when the Invergordon Mutiny occurred?
Well, there was no trouble in our ships, not in a China station. We just carried on as normal.
Why not?
Well, for one thing, we didn't know an awful lot about it. And I suppose we were more law-abiding, I don't know. But there was no earthly reason why we shouldn't. But I think we're so far away, and we accepted it.
You accepted the idea of the cut.
The cut, yes, but not the nobody accepted a way in which it was done. I mean, for instance, a commander earning £3 a day had a reduction of a shilling in his money. An AB who had 4 shillings a day still had it, as you probably know, was more or less what caused the mutiny. And well, that's about all I can tell you. We didn't think it was necessary to mutiny, obvious. And there was no sign of unrest in the China fleet. If there was, I didn't know anything about it.
What did you all think of the people who had mutinied at Invergordon?
Well, I thought there was a better ways of doing it. For instance, you've got members of Parliament, though they weren't so approachable in those days. But there again, you were not allowed to approach a member of Parliament without getting permission. That's as far as my memory serves me, and I think I'm right in that.
Did anybody approach an MP, do you know?
No, not to my knowledge. Don't forget, I was a very junior able seaman. I mean, there's lots of people... We had the lower deck lawyers, the same as everybody else, but I've also done, when you assess them. They're a joke more than anything else, aren't they? Well, they weren't anything to... They wouldn't impress me.
How did you come to transfer to the submarine service?
Well, there was a commander called Halloran, and he was in command of the submarine L4. So they had all L-class submarines out there then. That was before the advent of the O's and P's going out there. They went out there... They were just about starting to come out of that period. And there was a ship called the Irene, a merchant ship. And she was boarded by pirates who used to come out from Bias Bay. I don't know whether you know anything about the history of the piracy in China, do you?
I've heard that people speak something about it.
Well, apparently, though Bias Bay was 81 miles, I think, from Hong Kong, they knew when anything of importance, anybody worth a ransom, they knew beforehand when they were leaving Hong Kong. And they used to mingle with the steerage and sometimes the crew. And at a given time off Bias Bay, they'd take over the ship. Because all they had was a steel grill round the from the foredeck, round the bridge, and round the after part of the superstructure to stop any of the crew who were pirates from trying to take over the ship. Well, that's what they did with the Irene, anyway. And they took her into Bias Bay. And L4, under the command of Commander Halloran, went in there and seized the ship and released the prisoners. And I thought to myself, oh, this is more like it, instead of just, you know, not doing anything really. But we used to go around to different places, but I wanted more excitement. I suppose I felt that, you know, that's what I joined the Navy for. And
so how did you go about getting into the submarines?
Well, then I volunteered.
Did you have to approach a captain?
Yes, and then you have to make a request out. And then you're examined medically to see if you're mostly heart and lungs, as naturally with submarines, to see that you're fit. You've got to have a good character. And, well, generally you had to pass with whatever it was that they wanted you to do, which I did. And one day out of the blue in 1932, I was sent forth to the drafting office, and they said, your request has been granted, and you will join submarines forthwith.
In Hong Kong?
No, oh no. No, this is after I got home. I'm sorry, I've jumped a bit then. I got home and I was in the barracks at Chatham doing field training, which I hated anyway, running around with a rifle on your shoulder. And they sent me down the main drafting office, and a couple of days later I went to the submarine base.
Where was that?
Gosport, Dolphin.
And what happened to you there? What training did you receive?
I received, well, it was purely and simply, it was all submarine stuff, because they're entirely different to surface ships. And I seemed to settle in quite well. I have no regrets anyway. I met some damn good chaps, unfortunately. Most of them are dead. But, and I was sent...
Was there any part of the training which you found difficult to cope with?
No. I did very, very well, actually, on that... of the submarines, that's, you know, my career in submarines, that form.
What is it that you wanted to look at?
Well, I just wanted... The one that was very badly reproduced. You can see here, training class, the percentage I got was 90. So I was interested.
September 1932.
Yeah.
Was there any particularly unpleasant part of the training?
Well, I was a bit apprehensive about the DSCIA. I must admit I was a fairly decent swimmer. But I found that that was more or less easy. Eventually, I finished my time as a chief instructor up there, so as you will see in my service certificates.
How did they conduct the DSCA training in those days?
Well, we had a tank, not the one they have now. They've got a tank 115 foot. But we had an 18-foot tank. And the training classes, they had a day's instruction on how to use the Davis submerged escape apparatus. And we had lectures and so forth. And so what happened, as you know, as you were breathing, the percentage of nitrogen and oxygen in the air, and the CO2, which you breathe out, is not absorbed in the bloodstream, all that nonsense. But oxygen is. And you can, if you get too much CO2, you can get more what they call CO2 poisoning. And likewise, if you don't get sufficient oxygen lack, as we call it, you can do all sorts of silly things. You act as though you're... had too much to drink, in other words, as though you're drunk. And had all that exposure. Couldn't do a lot in 2 days. And then you went through the tank. You were taught how to use the apparatus, and you went through this tank.
Did you feel that the training that you got at Dolphin adequately prepared you for what was to come?
Well, submarines are like everything else. They train you for these things and give you as much knowledge as they possibly can about what will happen. Sometimes you go through submarines and you don't even come across this situation. But if you do, you know what to do. It's not like getting a degree at Oxford or Cambridge. It was sufficient anyway. And then I spent a short time on L-56, which is a double-gun L-boat. I left her. She was training, actually. So, I mean, I'd only just been trained myself, but I was taking an active part in a submarine, which was going to sea. Training people came in a couple of weeks after me, which I thought was a bit ridiculous, but still, that's you would think that they had for training somebody who was a bit more experienced. But anyway, I went to L-56 under the command of a very famous submarine officer, Admiral Rohr, Sir Sidney Rohr. I don't know if you know him or heard of him.
I've read about him.
He was a First Sea Lord. And
what was he like to serve under?
He was the best. The best there really was. I mean, you've heard this silly phrase, you'd do anything for anybody, but I think I would for him. I had a couple of captains I would. But they didn't treat you as though you were stupid. They put a lot of faith in you and put you on your own mettle, not continuously picking on you or something like that ever. Which, unfortunately, as you know, you do get some people like that. And but they, especially Sammy, as we called him, he was a, well, for want of a better word, he was a gentleman. He really was. And that inspired confidence in me because I had confidence in him. And then I went to a new submarine, a Sturgeon. I think it's only nerves, actually.
That's right.
I went to see a Sturgeon, And I picked, I was made a leading seaman on there. And the leading seaman, they only had leading seaman and second coxswains in the early days on the SS. And I was made second coxswain of her, which I thought wasn't bad for my first real submarine. And I was on her for till 19. And I went to her in end of 1932, and I left her the end of 1933, I think it was. My dates might not be correct, but they're within a little, within 6 months anyway. I left her at the end of 33, and I went to China. And I went straight to the Pandora, a P-class submarine. Under the command of a Lieutenant Commander Slade. I don't know whether I should say this in that next piece or not. This is purely confidential, isn't it?
It's going on the record. Well, there's no reason why you shouldn't say it, I don't think.
Well, our captain, Slade, his wife was a devotee of Gandhi. That's all I know, but it's just maybe a point of interest.
You mean a political devotee?
Yeah.
She believed in Indian independence.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Did he believe, did her husband believe?
No, I don't think so. I have seen him since. He's dead now. But anyway, he was relieved by a commander called Eric Russell Gibson, who now is Lord Ashbourne, hereditary, when his father died. He was very efficient. He was the type of man, if he asked you a question about a submarine, he'd just join it. He said, if you don't know, say so. He said, but don't try to bullshit me. And he was quite good. I quite liked him. I got on fairly well with him too, I think. I think he's still around, but he must be about 95 now. And I haven't read in the papers that he's died. And then I picked up the petty officer's rate on the Pandora, and I was made second coxswain of her. And I came home in 1936, and just in time for the fire at the Crystal Palace. If you remember when it burnt down there?
Yes.
Not this has nothing to do with submarines. And then I was out of a job for about 6 months. And lo and behold, I went to the Porpoise, the mine layer, as second coxswain. And who should the captain be? But the bloke whom I joined submarines, Halloran, he was captain of the Porpoise then. And I was on her as second coxswain for about 6 months. And I went to the Sterlet as coxswain. She was built in 1936. With the captain was Myers, not the VC Myers, another Myers, Shorty Myers, champion chap he was. He was really was a fine captain. He'd been passed over for promotion,